This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can also be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Today we'll be talking with composer Stephen Mackey, whose piano concerto Stumbled to Grace was just performed on the 19th. He's a jazz guitarist and improviser as well as a classical composer and plays with the band Big Farm. We'll also talk with flutist and teacher Nadine Aysen and piano student and teacher Angie Zhang. Let's start with a conversation with Stephen Mackey, whose piano concerto Stumbled to Grace was performed last Sunday with soloist Orly Shaham.
Well, I started out life as an electric guitar player, rock musician, blues, got into jazz towards the end of my teens, and had not heard classical music at that point until I was 19. For the first time, as part of a course in University of California, heard classical music, and it completely blew me away. I mean, I grew up with rock music in the late 60s, early 70s, so when I heard classical music, it was like, this is the most psychedelic rock music that I'd ever heard. Mm-hmm. And I, right then, really changed my life. I just thought, yeah, that's what I should be doing. So it's not typical, and it's also not easy to go from being illiterate, in a sense, musically. I didn't know how to read music, to being a composer. In fact, many advisors said, oh, it's too late, sorry, you know, give it up. But it turns out that learning notation wasn't that difficult for me. I mean, I was a serious guitarist. I mean, I played guitar all the time. I was a very serious musician, as a lot of rock musicians are. I just didn't know how to read music. So when I made the transition into composing, I first sort of repressed my guitar background and kind of wanted to learn what the practice of the time was in university. But as I graduated and got my degrees, I realized, well, my teachers were paid to be interested in what I do, and now nobody's interested in what I do. What do I want to do? And it wasn't even that conscious a decision to mix rock influence with classical music influence. It was just a natural thing, because I spent a decade then formally studying music, repressing my rock background before they really started to come together in a natural way.
And it seems like the first thing you have to do is to have a certain self-confidence that you have teachers that aren't really interested in you or say, ah, it's too late, you're just a aging rock guitarist of 19, whatever. Yeah. And so what are you doing here in conservatory? These guys, kids have been practicing their violin and piano.
Playing Mozart piano concertos when they were eight.
So who are you to come in and do that?
Exactly.
So you have to overcome that. It seems that having listened to some of your music, that not only does your jazz background come into play or your rock background, but also an interest in music from all over the world. Can you chat a little bit about that and how that finds its way not only into the music we've just heard, but some of the other pieces you've written?
You put your finger on it. I want my music to be kind of in touch with the fundamental urges that gave rise to music in the first place. I mean, we invented music, the human race invented music to dance to sing, to aid in transcendent experiences. And I want my music to be a part of that, not to be so abstract. And that's why I look to vernacular music of our cultures, my own vernacular music, which is rock music and jazz, and vernacular music of all cultures that's tied to ritual, it's tied to human celebration and human suffering. And so I just love that idea. But I also like the classical music tradition of innovation, of generation after generation. There's a certain amount of historical imperative that as a composer, you're expected to get a new take on things, or a different take on things. So I like the interest in the, for lack of a better word, the exoticism of music from around the world. And I don't actually know enough about the specifics of music around the world to, and it's a good thing because I can't plagiarize. I take this idea of music that's in touch with ritual and human celebration. I take that idea and then invent my own culture. In fact, there aren't many things that critics have said about me that I'd want to quote, but one is he writes vernacular music from a culture that doesn't really exist. And I really like that. That is sort of an aspiration of mine.
That's great. Yeah. Now, when you came into the classical music world, one thing that you had to give up was a stable of musicians who know how to improvise. And I'm friends with really famous violinists and others who, if I just gave them a C major chord and a G major chord and played back and forth, they would be helpless. And coming from the rock and jazz world, improvisation is like everything.
Everything.
So first of all, how do you write for a classically trained musician who doesn't have any sense of improvisation or how to just breathe music in the moment as opposed to reading what's on the score? Where by the way, they do breathe into that.
Yeah,
But they have to have that structure before they can do it.
It's true. Well, I have a lot of things to say about that. I have a friend and colleague who was waiting to talk to me, and he was sitting in my office looking at a score. And when I came in, he said, "You know, Steve, I really realized looking at your score, I can really see your improvisation background and your guitar background, because clearly the music is in your head and you struggle and wrestle it into notation." And a lot of that wrestling has to do with trying to capture a sense of spontaneity.
Sure.
And I often find myself telling musicians, "You've got to play this like you made it up."
Right.
And some of the complicated, often the complicated rhythms in that one might encounter in my music are a kind of a free kind of blowing across the changes that an improviser would do.
Sure.
And certainly improvising is central to my compositional process. I mean, pretty much everything I do starts off with a little germ that came out of an improvisation.
Well, let's ask specifically about Orly Shaham, mm-hmm. this fantastic, talented pianist from a fantastically talented family.
The royal family of
the royal family of music. Oh, it's incredible. Yeah. And Orly has at least one recording, or maybe two recordings, with your music and John Adams's music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this, to me, must have just incredibly warmed your heart that a musician of that caliber, and frankly, with those connections, decided that she liked your music enough to
commission me.
Tell us how she discovered you and what has happened there musically between the two of you.
Her husband is David Robertson, mm-hmm. you know, one of the world's great, great conductors. And so speaking about a royal family, I mean, the in-laws, everybody in that
yes.
family is incredible. I met David and Orly here at Aspen. Mm-hmm. In 2007, when David conducted me performing electric guitar concerto of mine with the Aspen Festival Orchestra mm-hmm. on the Sunday at 2 concert. He really liked the piece, and Orly really liked the piece, and Orly was pregnant with twins. My wife was pregnant, and we just sort of had all these connections. Orly, again, an electric guitar concerto that I was doing, she could hear that kind of freedom that we've been talking about, and that kind of Americanness and that kind of extrovertedness, and mm-hmm. she was really mm-hmm. drawn to that. And we were also just drawn personally together as soon-to-be parents, and the couples, you know, got along really well. And it was a couple years later that actually David had asked me, that said, Orly has been wanting to commission a piano concerto. She just couldn't decide who she wanted to commission it from. And by then, David had done other music of mine, a violin concerto in particular that he did. And apparently that really turned the corner, and Orly said, "Yeah, I want my piano concerto to come from Steve." And so she asked me to write her a concerto, and I really wrote this for her and to showcase some incredible strengths that she has as a pianist.
Well, I think one of those strengths, in a sense, might be a spiritual strength of sorts. Well, first of all, the title of the work, Stumble to Grace, that's three words that really talks a lot about the human condition, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
As soon as I read that title, I thought, yeah, there have been a lot of times in my life that I've stumbled to grace. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us a little bit about that title and how it not only in this particular work that we heard a couple of days ago, but some of your other works.
Yeah.
How does the spiritual journey guide your music too?
Well, in this particular piece, that title is a comment again on that personal connection that Orly and David and my wife Sarah and I had around our new families. The title comes from me watching my, you know, young, not quite toddler, because he wasn't toddling yet, go from
right.
being an infant to learning to walk, and just this, mm-hmm. you know, this perseverance and the stumbling and the falling and the unintentional running, you know, just leaning too far forward and then splat. And her children were going through the same thing. And so it just seemed like an apt title. It also seemed like an apt kind of concept, this idea of playing with this continuum of awkwardness and gracefulness. And the piano seemed ideal casting for that, since one of my great pianistic influences is Thelonious Monk,
mm-hmm,
whose
mm-hmm.
style is very, plays with all thumbs. And on the other hand, to me, the ultimate virtuosity is somebody like Rosalind Turek playing Bach fugues on the piano. I mean, just that's virtuosity, keeping track of all these voices and it's just flying, or Glenn Gould playing Goldberg variations, that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the piano seemed like a really good player to capture that whole continuum of awkwardness to gracefulness. But I realized that, you know, the same few ideas just circle around in a composer's head, that, as you point out, most of my music has that kind of, I like wit in music, and I also like transcendence in music, and most of my music tends to be a one-way journey and aims for some sort of transcendence that's very, you know, I go for a kind of a three-legged dog kind of grace, you know, so
mm-hmm,
a lot of my
mm-hmm.
music limps along, but hopefully achieves some sort of transcendence, not in spite of, but because of its challenges.
Mm-hmm,
maybe
mm-hmm.
that's my own background as a composer too.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Chris Moore, and I have been interviewing composer Stephen Mackey. And now we'll go from Mackey's non-traditional instrumentation to the oldest and the most traditional instrument of all, the flute, which goes back at least 35,000 years and was discovered in Germany in a cave the wing of a griffon vulture had holes carefully put into the side of it, and a culture that is believed to have groups of people that used to enjoy drinking beer, playing the flute and drums around the campfire to stay warm. Here's modern flutist Nadine Aysen. Well, Nadine, you are a master of the most ancient and most traditional instrument in the world. I don't think there's any instrument that is known out there to have existed longer than the flute. And the modern flute doesn't sound tremendously different from the flutes from 35,000 years ago, somewhat.
Well,
they're better tuned.
Really? I mean, they're made out of very different materials. The flutes of 35,000 years ago were made out of
bones,
a stick or a bone. And my flute is made out of gold and silver right. and platinum. So,
And let me ask, do those beautiful metals that you have make it possible for the sound of the flute to have more depth or more resonance? And I ask that because people tend to think of the flute as a pretty soft instrument. I think sometimes it picks up resonance.
Chris.
Oh, I know. I'm just throwing stereotypes at you, seeing what you have to say.
Well, yes, and that's why there is constant evolution of the instrument, mm-hmm. because players are trying to find the next great material that will satisfy them in terms of creating a beautiful sound. And certainly as composers write different roles for the flute within symphonic writing or chamber music, the materials of the flute change as flutists want to develop their own kind of color palette of sound.
Here in Aspen, I think you are on that plaque that's in the tent of teachers that have been here for 25 years or more. So you must, in addition to loving Miami and the beautiful weather and everything, you must love being up here in the summer, or you wouldn't spend that many years here.
Absolutely. No, I'm quite honored to have my name on that plaque, mm-hmm. and I'm quite honored to be a longstanding faculty artist member. It's really a transformative festival, mm-hmm. and I look forward to it for many, many reasons. Certainly, first and foremost, are my students who I just adore, who keep me on my toes in so many different ways, and certainly the ensembles I play with, both the orchestra and the chamber music opportunities I have out here. Asador is wonderful about asking me what I'd like to play and, you know, just kind of tweaking me and provoking me into playing lots of different works that I may not have known. So it's just been a wonderful, wonderful part of my musical life.
Speaking of tweaking and provoking, I noticed that the students who are here seem to love to be tweaked and provoked by teachers that really take them past where they even think they can be.
Absolutely.
I'm hoping you're one of those teachers that is somehow, without using a whip, inspiring them to push past their own envelope or their own limitations.
Absolutely. Well, also the fact that the festival lasts for 8 weeks, it's really mm-hmm. amazing how much development and progress a student can make in an 8-week period. It's really mm-hmm. staggering. Mm-hmm. The amount of repertoire these students learn and perform, plus the demands that their private teachers make upon them, plus lots of different performance opportunities, everything from Paradise Bakery to sitting on the stage of Harris Hall and playing your Prokofiev Sonata, or sitting next to your teacher in the Festival Orchestra or the Chamber Symphony. Mm-hmm. So there is such a range and a scope of opportunity for these students here. They grab these opportunities and run with it. I mean, the level of enthusiasm among the students is really very inspiring.
So my last question is that next performance that's coming up on the 27th of July, there's a woodwind quartet, and there aren't very many of those in the repertoire of Francais, and I think a second one by another composer.
That's right. I'm very delighted to take part in this performance. We're playing two quartets and woodwind quartet, so that's flute, oboe, clarinet, and bassoon, mm-hmm. so minus the French horn. Mm-hmm. And one of the quartets is by Jean Francais, this very witty, urbane, parentheses, technically difficult, French mm-hmm. composer of the late 20th century, but very, I don't want to scare our audience away because it's very tuneful. It's very, you'll sit there and wish you had a martini in your hand when you hear the music. And then the other piece is I'm fairly certain it's an Aspen premiere, and it may be even larger than that. It was written by the father of one of our local Aspen citizens, Thore Goldstein's father. The last name is Jansson. Same instrumentation. And we'll be performing it in the tent on Monday the 27th. And it looks like a very interesting piece. And we're eagerly rehearsing and getting ready to perform it. So we hope everybody out there in Radioland will come and spur us on.
Well, we look forward to enjoying that. And again, Nadine, thank you so much for your time to come here at Aspen Public Radio and talk to our audience.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Flutist Nadine Aysen plays music of Francais and Jansson in a chamber music concert on Monday, July 27th. Now let's catch up with a very busy 19-year-old pianist, Angie Zhang. Well, Angie, I first saw you perform on July 5th with the Schumann Piano Quartet, which was a wonderful performance. And then the next day, I saw you again at the Aspen Physics Center performing solo. And then I guess you got on a plane and went to Missouri.
The next day.
The day after that. And I guess they gave you a pass to leave for a while to perform with the Missouri Symphony, the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto.
That's right.
Now you're back here again.
I am.
Have you been getting enough sleep? I mean, this is an amazing schedule you have.
I would say I did get enough sleep. For some reason, at 5-something, the ravens start crowing. And that's basically the alarm clock. So everyone just wakes up. I'm in the front room this time at Marolt Housing. And so my room gets pretty light right at, you know, when the sun rises. But I do get to sleep enough, I think. A lot of it's just mental, you know, did I sleep enough or not?
Right.
But I think, you know, every day in Aspen is it's full of surprises, and I'm enjoying it so much. I don't think I'm really worried about sleep anymore.
Now, you were, in addition to taking these lessons from these amazing people, you're also a teacher. Tell us a little bit about your role as a teacher, because you're 19 years old, so you're kind of in this transition period in your life.
So in the future, I do want to be a teacher, either at a conservatory or a college or Juilliard, where I am right now. And I just think since teachers have played such an important role in my life, and I've been so blessed and lucky to have great teachers play, you know, great music and teach me all that they have. I think it's, I really think it's important to keep that going. So since they've influenced me so much, I hope to influence little kids now. And so I'm a third year PALS teaching fellow, third consecutive year. And I have a couple students who I've been with from previous years. And they just requested me again. And they're lovely students from the Roaring Fork Valley. And I even teach one full-time through FaceTime almost every week. And that's been going really well. And to see him again is phenomenal, and see how much he can grow. It just, you know, it just brings me to tears sometimes to see, you know, how much they really love music. And I get to see them a lot at concerts, at the tent, and they have such great family support. And so I think that really matters. And having students who come from a great family who support them for every endeavor that they choose to challenge themselves with is fantastic. So I hope if I come back to do this again.
Angie, what are some of the most important lessons you feel like you've learned from Wuhan and some of the other teachers that you've had, even this season, this short season so far?
Well, I think my playing has definitely grown since having so many hours with Wuhan, Mr. Finkel, and all the other great artist faculty from the Aspen Music School. I think what Wuhan really stresses is looking at the page and seeing what, you know, you can decipher from the page and doing justice to the music. And to me, that's obviously because I was in the program last year, it really hit me hard too last year. Mm-hmm. But this year, just reinforcing it, now I'm looking at all my new pieces in a different way. Obviously, I was always careful about details, but now I think it's definitely on a different level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you play, and actually when you speak in a very animated way, and you play in a very animated way, which is great, because one of my fears all the time is that if you overthink music, then you're going to sound almost robotic. But at the same time, it seems as though a lot of thought and detail has to go into mm-hmm. into preparing yourself.
Right.
How do you give yourself permission to be spontaneous when it's the time to actually walk in front of an audience?
So in the practice room, I really have to do a lot of work. I'm trying to figure out different phrases, you know, where the top of the phrase is, how I'm going to taper it off, or is the end of a phrase going to lead into my next phrase? I mean, every time I play the piece, it's a little different. Every time I think mm-hmm. a little differently, for the most part, I know what I want to do. It just pretty much, I still think about all the different details and work and thought that I've put into the music in the practice room. But on stage, I think it's just important to let go. And hopefully you did enough work in the practice room and outside that when you're in that moment, you don't really have to think about the little details because they'll just happen to be there so that they'll appear and it'll be the way you want it to be. And hopefully that's persuasive. So that's another thing that Wuhan has really been stressing, is that you really want to get your intention out to the audience. And mm-hmm. so I've been mm-hmm. really thinking about that because I think that's really important. And I was at their concert when they played the cello piano chamber music recital, the first one of the season.
Mm-hmm.
I really felt that every single note that they played, it was full of intention.
Mm-hmm.
And I really understood it, like their right. emotion, everything just came out into Harris Hall, even the mm-hmm. back row. And I think in the future, that's something that I want to continue working on.
We've been talking with pianist Angie Zhang. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 and Saturdays at 3 o'clock for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.